Do you want to learn interesting psychological information in an easy, straightforward, and entertaining manner? Then you need to listen to The Shrink Is In, a podcast show produced and hosted by Dr. Howard Gurr. Dr. Gurr is a practicing licensed psychologist for more than 25 years in New York State, and now he is available to you on the internet. Now, here's Dr. Howard Gurr.
Hey, it's Dr. Gurr with another psychological podcast for The Shrink Is In. And today I'm going to be talking to Dr. Peter Lambrow, who is a licensed clinical and health psychologist who specializes in anxiety, weight loss, and emotional management. And the topic for today is anxiety. And the title of the podcast is a bit lofty. It's called Anxiety, the 21st Century Disease of Civilization. And today we're going to find out what that really means. But before we do that, let me give you some background on Dr. Lambrow. Dr. Peter Lambrow is a licensed clinical and health psychologist, a specialist in anxiety, weight loss, and emotional management. Dr. Lambrow is the vice chair of psychology at Scripps Memorial Hospital in La Jolla, California, where he's maintained a private practice since 1987. And he's on the faculty of the University of California at San Diego. Dr. Lambrow is a fellow of the American Institute of Stress, a diplomate in behavioral medicine, and the author of several books on hypnosis and other methods of emotional regulation and behavior change. In addition, Dr. Lambrow has his own website, which is called www.stopanxietynow.com, where he gives strategies and tips on how to handle anxiety. And now, let's meet Dr. Lambrow. So, Peter, welcome to The Shrink Is In.
Thank you, Howie. Glad to be with you.
So, Peter, we have this lofty title for this podcast today. And my question really is, why do we call anxiety the disease of civilization?
That's a good question. You know, we're wired, designed, and created to respond to stressful situations in a very specific way for a healthy response, and that is we've been designed to respond in a sort of acute way, a quick way of responding with a stress response, activating the body, getting us ready to do that classic fight, flight, or in some cases, freeze. And that was great during the evolution of mankind when the threats were rather sudden and could be resolved rather quickly and easily. And that worked for us for, you know, thousands, even perhaps tens of thousands of years. But as we evolved modern civilization, the kinds of threats we face are not, tigers and wild animals and marauding tribes so much as the traffic on the way to work, financial problems, things that are going on that do not have a way of responding quickly and resolving it, and then that stress response going away. So we live in sort of a chronic state of stress and anxiety that doesn't go away, and most people have never learned a way to manage those kinds of situations effectively for their body and for their mind, and therefore it has become the number one problem, that is to say anxiety conditions in general, number one emotional or psychological problem in America today.
Yeah, I guess we've kind of walked ourselves right into a chronic problem by civilizing ourselves and making stress something we have to live with as opposed to something we have to react to on a sporadic basis.
Exactly.
So, you know, all right, so we live with this kind of low-level to moderate-level stress all the time. How does somebody know when, you know, let's say their level of stress or anxiety is worthy of some kind of intervention or treatment?
Yes, you know, that's something that people have to monitor for themselves to a certain extent because we all naturally will experience, as I was mentioning before, to have anxiety or fear is a quite natural experience. However, when that anxiety or fear starts to interfere with one's life in a significant way, for example, interfering in our occupational life or interfering in our academic life if we're going to school or in our social life or in any significant area of our lives, then we start to look at it as potentially being a clinical syndrome that deserves really clinical attention. To have some anxiety about, a test coming up in school or having some anxiety about a job interview or something like that that is rather temporary. It may even be very strong for a short period of time but then goes away. that would be in the rather normal category. But if we're having, say, panic attacks, not just once in a great while as a result of some situational stress, but having them, say, once or twice or three times a month, and developing even a second fear, which is the fear of having a panic mm-hmm. attack or having an anxiety attack, we're starting to reach that threshold where it may be a clinical syndrome. And the best thing in a situation like that where a person may suspect it is to either see a professional, or they may take an online questionnaire or survey, and there are many that are available. I have one on my website and the National Institutes of Health. There's lots of places where you can take an online screening, we might say. It's not going to diagnose, but it's going to just give an idea whether the symptoms that you're experiencing are to a clinical level, to a level that deserves attention. Incidentally, about almost 1 in 5 people in America will have a level of clinical anxiety deserving of attention sometime in their lives. So that's a fairly significant number of people in the United States.
Do we have any statistics on how many of those people actually seek treatment?
Yes, only about a fourth of those people, only about a quarter of those individuals who actually suffer will get properly diagnosed and get proper treatment.
Mm-hmm.
Not very many.
No, it's unfortunate, I know, because there are lots of people out there who really, unfortunately, don't talk about it. You know, I have people in my practice who are shocked and amazed that they're not the only ones out there with, you know, panic disorders or anxiety reactions that are excessive. You know, I what I tell them is walk down the street, count every 10 people you see, and I guarantee one of them has it.
That's a good way of understanding it. And I think you're right, for people to understand that it's a common condition, many people suffer, and perhaps most importantly, that there are very effective treatments available. People do not have to continue to suffer their entire lives with these kinds of conditions.
Well, that leads me to my next question. What is the most effective therapeutic modality or approach for anxiety reactions?
Well, Howie, that's been studied quite a bit, and there's a significant body of research and published literature that cognitive behavioral therapy is a very effective treatment for anxiety conditions. And we're talking about anxiety conditions such as generalized anxiety, where people have sort of a feeling of irritability, tension, worry that goes on much of the time. It may ebb and flow, but it's sort of a chronic ongoing condition. And another common one is panic disorder, and there are several different versions, but people have these acute attacks often lasting 10 minutes to 30 minutes of very severe symptoms that really cause them extraordinary distress, even the feeling like they're going to die at times. And then there's post-traumatic stress disorder, mm-hmm. and there's social anxiety. There's a number of different anxiety conditions, but almost all of those respond very well to cognitive behavioral therapy. But there's also medication therapy that is very effective as well. But the research has shown that cognitive behavioral therapy is as effective as medication in symptom relief, but has the advantage of really extending the relief long after the therapy is concluded, whereas medication works very well while people are taking the medications, but when they stop taking it, the symptoms tend to return at a much higher frequency.
That's an interesting concept, you know, because I've always worked under the concept that CBT, which if anyone's listened to my podcast, they know that I'm a CBT-er from way back, uh-huh. but that cognitive behavior therapy plus medication was just an ideal combination. You know, both of them individually help, but together that combination really works well. But the concept that when somebody stops taking the medication, that benefit is gone, or maybe even the symptoms are you know, rebound to a certain extent. That's an interesting concept. I never really put it that way, but I'm going to use it. Sorry,
and you're right. And you're right that for some people, the combination is really important because the symptoms they're experiencing are so debilitating or so interfering, even in their ability to undergo therapy, that the medication opens a window up for them to be able to benefit from the cognitive behavioral therapy.
Right. The other piece that I always say to my people is, look, if in fact the medication and even the CBT together gives you this sense of what life could be like without this anxiety, this pervasive anxiety, even if, let's say, the medication stops and you know, you don't take it anymore and, you know, you're no longer in treatment, at least you know what to shoot for. You know how it feels. And you know that you could obtain that level of life satisfaction. But many people are so anxiety-ridden for years and years and years, they have no idea what it is to be calm or relaxed anymore.
That is so true. One individual comes to mind that I worked with a couple of years ago. He had been suffering from panic attacks for well over 20 years, and he had to fly considerably in his work. Put on well over 100,000 miles of travel a year. And he would land in different cities having had a panic attack during the flight and go to emergency rooms. And he had been to something like 30 emergency room visits. And each time, of course, reassured that he's not having a heart attack. But when he's having that panic attack, mm-hmm. It feels life-threatening. And he was responding very well to the CBT, even though he had been suffering that extraordinarily long period of time.
Mm-hmm. You know, in CBT, there are things like cognitive distortions and cognitive traps. Maybe you can explain to those people listening to us what those things are.
There's a number of different formulations, as you know, Howie, that have been developed. Dr. David Burns, one of the specialists in this area, author of the Feeling Good Handbook, has probably identified the list of cognitive distortions that's used most often. And one of those is an example is all or nothing thinking, probably one of the more common ones for people suffering from anxiety. And, you know, just before I go on that, I want to just comment that anxiety and depression go hand in hand. And in fact, the research shows that about 50% of the time a person is experiencing anxiety, they will also be having significant depression and vice versa. So those two conditions seem to be linked in some way, and as we're learning more through sophisticated brain imaging, it appears that anxiety and depression may simply be two different expressions of the same condition. But nonetheless, the treatments are fundamentally the same for both anxiety and depression.
Mm-hmm.
So we see these cognitive distortions occurring, and all or nothing thinking is one that's very common for people with anxiety. And an example is people will recognize that if they're saying to themselves things like, always, I'm always this, or never, it's never this or that, or everyone thinks this about me, or no one likes me, these kinds of extreme or polarized thinking, black and white thinking, are one of the cognitive distortions that are common. And the way to handle that is to start to recognize that that's occurring. So as people start to hear their own self-talk through the process of cognitive behavioral therapy, they can recognize they're doing that and start to interrupt it. Another one, too, Howie, that's mm-hmm. I think very important to share is Dr. David Barlow at Boston University identified a common distortion pattern with anxiety, and that is the distortion of underestimating the resources that a person has and overestimating the threat that they're experiencing. So, for an example, thinking of a person who overestimates the fear that they're having of embarrassing themselves by having a panic attack.
Mm-hmm.
So they perceive that if they have a panic attack in a public place, that they're going to be humiliated, that they're going to lose really the respect of everyone, even though the experience of having a panic attack, even in public, probably would be understood by a vast majority of people that it's simply a condition they experience temporarily. So they overestimate the threat of that experience, or we might extend that to any kind of situation, fear of driving on the freeway or fear of being in an elevator or whatever, and underestimating mm-hmm. their resources, that they have the capacity to learn relaxation training, to be able to relax their body, to learn how to change their thought patterns that will alter the emotions that they're experiencing, to change their behavior patterns so that they reduce the stress in their lives. So those are two good examples of cognitive distortions that people can have. And of course, there are many others, such as overdoing the shoulds. People many times will say to themselves, I really should do this, I really have to do that. And the question that I ask people to ask themselves is, who says so? And that's a way of interrupting that pattern of putting pressure on oneself, which feeds the anxiety pattern. So those are some mm-hmm. ways of interfering with the distortions and bring themselves back down to a more rational and calm level.
Yeah, we on Long Island here, many of us were trained by Albert Ellis.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. And I don't know if you know the public out there doesn't know.
Rational emotive therapy.
Yes. But Ellis he passed away last year, but Ellis was a kind of cantankerous guy who would try to shock his patients. And so one of the things that we picked up over the years are, you know, little Ellisisms. And one of them was called the shame attack.
Mm-hmm.
And what I used to do, and I haven't done it a long time, but I'm on Long Island, and there's a huge shopping center, a big mall. And I used to send my patients into the mall with the assignment of announcing the time of the day at the top of their lungs. And, you know, many people refused to do it, but the people who actually did do it would come back and say, you know, I thought I would be embarrassed and upset, and everyone would think I was crazy. And they kind of looked at me for a split second and then moved on. And it was nothing. And
that's a great example, and, you know, of taking people out to that threat mm-hmm. that they fear so greatly and mm-hmm. for them to recognize that their imagined consequences are not anywhere near what they had estimated them to be. That they
exactly.
overestimated that threat.
And if they would do
actually,
it.
Yeah. Howie, I do a similar thing mm-hmm. on the Scripps campus. My practice is at Scripps Memorial Hospital, which is a large medical, general medical hospital. And one of the things that I've done with clients when they fear that they're going to do something to embarrass themselves, much like what you were talking about, I'll actually walk out with them on the campus, and we'll take a walk, and then I'll get down on the sidewalk and kind of huddle up as if I'm having a panic attack.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, they're kind of startled. Of course, I've told them what I'm going to do. And then I stand up and I say, look around, you know, what's the terrible thing that's happened as a result of me coming down there for a minute and shaking?
Mm-hmm.
And the answer is that, you know, no one really is that concerned because I'm not appearing to be in that great a distress. Now, you know, I suppose if I passed out that someone would come to my attention, but the vast majority of times people are not really that concerned unless it's a real tragedy, unless it's something what Ellis would call a catastrophe.
Right. You know, the interesting thing, yesterday I had a guy in my practice who's he works in security. And he was talking to somebody, and he had a panic attack. And he excused himself, said he had to go to the bathroom, and came back, and everything was fine. And I said, so what happened when you came back? Did the woman say anything? He said, absolutely no. And I said, you know what? When you got to the bathroom, did you think you were like so – like there was a neon sign on you that said having a panic attack? I said, what happened? He said, well, I was completely white. You know, he lost the blood in his face. And I said, okay, so what? Did this woman see that? He said, no. I said, you're painfully aware of how you feel. You know exactly what's going on in your body. I said, but you know what? Other people don't know. You know, there are many people having panic attacks that they have no idea. Nobody knows what's going on because they can't read you. But, you know, when you think everyone knows you're having a panic attack, you're only making it worse.
That's a very good example also of one of those distortions called emotional reasoning,
mm-hmm.
that because a person feels like they are very conspicuous or that they're standing out in some way or that their symptoms are just broadcasting outward, even though they feel that way, that's not reality.
Exactly.
And so emotional reasoning is one of those distortions that we can help people bring under control by recognizing that how they feel is not a good estimation or a good measure of reality.
You know, Peter, on your website, you have the 30 free tips and strategies for overcoming anxiety and panic attacks. And you have one that's number 10, I believe, which is significant. Can you explain what that is?
I think number 10 is the one about perfectionism.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, that, just to take a step back for a moment, Howie, that what I created in those 30 tips and strategies for anxiety and panic were heavily influenced by cognitive behavioral therapy. So there's a number of different strategies there that are drawn from that CBT concept. And one of the elements that's very common with people suffering from anxiety is this notion of perfectionism. And a lot of the symptoms or a lot of the processes that underlie anxiety originate in our childhood life experiences, in our early life experiences. And while most of the work is focused on here and now, what's going on with teaching people new ways of thinking and new patterns, understanding that many of the processes began early on is helpful. And perfectionism is one of those that typically originates in early life. And it develops from the sense of having to get approval or the struggle to get approval, usually from one of our parents or a major caregiver. And that struggle leads one to try and do it better and better and better with the notion of if there is perfection, then I will get approval. And, you know, it may have come from sports or academics in early life, but it extends now into almost every area or major areas of one's life. Just to explain how that works, for many people, they really don't understand or see themselves as being perfectionistic or striving for perfection because they may not express it to themselves that way. I'm thinking of a woman that I was working with last year, and I was explaining this concept to her because from what she had told me, I could see that that was something going on in her life.
Mm-hmm.
She really denied it, and she says, I don't think I'm really that way. And I let it go, and she made some progress, but then she discontinued therapy for a while, and she came back a couple of months later, and she said, you know, I just came back from a visit with my family back. In fact, it was in the Boston area. And she said, you know, after you had talked about that issue of perfectionism, she says, I came to my family get together, and I realized how much we really are all similar in trying to do the very best we can, and we stress ourselves. And I saw it in my brother and sisters, but I didn't realize it in myself until I went back there and started to see it in my family.
Mm.
And then she went on to explain how it was so difficult to please her father growing up, that her father would have very high standards for everyone and often would humiliate family members when they didn't agree with him. And so she had developed this pattern of trying to get it just right, and it had extended into her work life. And that was really a major contributor to her anxiety symptoms. She was putting a lot of pressure on herself. And that's really the underlying process of perfectionism, is that it creates a tremendous amount of pressure within that is a very difficult thing for people to manage. And, you know, I give the example to people to understand how that could affect them. If you are trying to hold a beach ball in a pool or, you know, in a pond or somewhere or body of water that you're in, and you're pushing that beach ball down under the water and trying to hold it there, you can imagine how much effort it takes.
Mm-hmm.
And that's kind of the analogy to the pressure of trying to get it right, trying to constantly do the right thing. And, of course, if you slip, that beach ball pops up. So the effort is always there to kind of keep it managed. So perfectionism is something that people really need to attend to if that's going on. And I would say that a lot of people that suffer from anxiety will notice that in their patterns.
You know, your number 12 tip, by the way, is an interesting one to me because it's something that shows up probably, I think, in 100% of my cases.
Mm-hmm.
I find that the issue of control is a major factor in probably every single one of my panic or anxiety patients. I find them generally to be brighter people who are very cognizant of what's going on around them and inside of them, and they're very, very introspective, almost too introspective and too much into analyzing what's going on around them. And the issue of being in control, you know, or the conflict between external and internal locus of control is a big issue. And that's, you know, your number 12 tip. So maybe we could talk about that.
You're exactly right. And in fact, just to highlight that component of we might call them the background characteristics that are very common with people suffering from one or another anxiety condition. They are tending to be very thoughtful and intelligent, we might even say intellectually oriented people. They tend to be rather analytical, thoughtful, trying to figure things out and understand things. Unfortunately, with the inability or the diminished ability to turn that off, by the way. And they also tend to be very sensitive people, sensitive to sights and sounds and smells, and certainly sensitive to the feelings of other people. So, and often when I mention that, I say, has anyone ever told you that you were a sensitive person, or do you notice that about yourself? And the vast majority of people will recognize that. And that locus of control, that where it's located, and externally means that a person is focused on what the outside world is experiencing about them to get a gauge of who they are and how they are. And that what we really want is more of an internal sense of being in control of ourselves, of who we are and how we think about ourselves.
Mm-hmm.
Just to put that in relief in a example, there's an individual, a fellow that I'm thinking of that's a classic example of that. And again, growing up in a family where the control was outside of him, that is to say, again, in a parent, he was very concerned about his appearance of being competent and looking confident, especially in his work life. And so he would really feel good when people around him, his customers and clients, when his colleagues and coworkers all really valued him and thought highly of him. So then he would feel good about himself. But if for some reason a customer or client was unhappy with something, dissatisfied, then he would diminish. He would just shrink down and feel that he was just about an inch and a half high because their opinion became his opinion of himself. So that's an example of external locus of control where what's going on the outside world influences significantly how we perceive ourselves, how we feel about ourselves. Now, when I tell him, I say, look at the evidence here. You have this huge pattern of doing things well, of a lot of compliments, a lot of positive things going on. Why would one person saying something bad about you influence that huge body of information that you have that's real and tangible? Well, it wasn't a very rational thing, but that's how these processes are, Howie. They are very mm-hmm. irrational.
Right.
But that's the process of CBT, is to bring that irrationality up to light and also provide an alternative way to manage that. So the strategy there is to bring that locus of control, that perception of oneself internally, so or more internal. It's not a matter of all or nothing. Again, we don't want to fall into that trap, but that it's more internal than it is external. And therefore, we can withstand, say, some setbacks or criticisms and so forth and not be devastated by that and consequently feeling extremely anxious.
Mm. You know, speaking of anxiousness and anxiety and that whole thing about how other people, you know, view me, You know that my logic is that I have people who have the same issue, and I say, look, if you met 100 people today, and 99 of them liked you, but one of them didn't like you, where would you be focusing? And they all say, well, why did that one person not like me? And I would say, why are you disregarding the other 99 who did?
Exactly. Why did 99 people like you? That's mm-hmm. a much better question.
Right.
Must have been doing something right. There must be some good qualities that you have.
So, but they don't look at it that way. And see, that leads me to my next question for you, Peter, which is the big world of social anxiety. And I know your tip number 28 is referring to something called a spotlight effect, and that's connected to kind of social anxiety and social phobia. Maybe you can explain that as well.
Yes. You know, social anxiety is something that is very significant in terms of the number of people. It's surprising how many people experience social anxiety. And just to kind of delineate a little bit here, many people suffer some apprehension or anxiety or stress, we might say, about going to a social function where they don't know anyone, or being the center of attention at a birthday party or someplace that's where they're kind of in the spotlight. And some of that is quite normal, so we don't want to make all social anxiety a problem. But for many people, that reaches a level where they avoid almost any kind of social interaction, especially where it's people that they may not know very well. And for some people with social anxiety, even getting together with a family is quite anxiety-producing.
Mm-hmm.
One of the things that happens, to come back to that spotlight effect, is the notion that they feel like they're in the spotlight and that all attention is focused on them. And that is one of those distortions as well. It's a distortion of perception. In other words, they've overestimated the threat. And a great example of this is a research that was done by a researcher, Tom Gilovich, and his colleagues. And they set up this experiment. I'll just share briefly this experiment because it's kind of fascinating how it identifies this concept. What they did is they had a subject. This is a student. And this student was given a T-shirt. And the T-shirt had a large photo imprint on it of what at the time of the research was a very uncool musician. It happened to be, unfortunately for Barry Manilow at the time the research was done. Mm-hmm. So this subject was told to go into this room where a number of other students would be filling out a questionnaire. Now, he was the only one that was wearing this T-shirt. The other students were part of the research as well. They didn't know what this was all about. And after the subject went in for about 2 minutes, he was called back out of the room and asked to estimate how many people noticed this T-shirt and what was on it. And the estimate, generally on average, they did this a number of times, was about 45%. In other words, you said about half the people recognized that I was wearing a Barry Manilow T-shirt. Mm-hmm. And then they went back and they interviewed the people that were in the room, and they asked them, what did you notice about the fellow that had just left? And only about 20% recognized that he was wearing a Barry Manilow T-shirt. Again, they did this a number of times, and there was a lot of consistency, and they did some other versions of this kind of experiment. People overestimate how much attention they're getting or they're receiving in a social situation.
Mm-hmm.
That's what that little research project proved and has been demonstrated in a number of situations. People tend to believe that everyone's thinking about them, and therefore their anxiety goes up.
Right.
One of the things that I teach people, in addition to just sharing that kind of information so that they can be a little bit more grounded, is the concept of what I call the 95% rule. And while this is not exact science, the notion is that most of us are thinking about ourselves 95% of the time,
mm-hmm.
or the majority of the time. And like your experiment that you had with the asking the people to go out and announce the time.
Yeah, the shame attack. Yeah.
Shame attack.
Right.
This is an example where people can actually go out and experiment for themselves. So I ask them to go out and over the next week to look at how much they're thinking about themselves versus the people they're interacting with. And when they come back and keep some accurate tally of that, they acknowledge that most of the time they are thinking about themselves. And if they are thinking about someone else, it's usually what that other person is thinking about them. So it shows that most of us really, most of the time, are focused on ourselves, unless there's a specific reason to focus on someone else.
It's like
that helps people reduce their anxiety.
It's like that old joke, where somebody meets somebody at a party and they're dominating the conversation about themselves. And finally, the person says, listen, it's enough about me. Let's talk about you. And he says, so what do you think about me?
Yeah, exactly. Right. So that's the spotlight effect, and mm-hmm. helping people to recognize how those things are really not occurring helps them reduce their social anxiety. And plus, of course, learning some relaxation techniques and some other skills are necessary as well.
Peter, I'm sorry to tell you, but we're out of time.
Well,
I know that you have
so quickly.
Yeah, I know you have all these other tips and strategies on your website, and maybe you could announce where that is so people out there could contact you or get the information that you have. So
certainly.
What is your website?
If they go to www.stopanxietynow.com, mm-hmm. stopanxietynow.com, and that'll be a way for them to subscribe to this free service. It's 30 tips and strategies on overcoming anxiety, panic, and stress. Mm-hmm. And each one, they'll receive a message. They're audio messages where I share within 3 to 5, 7 minutes at the most, one or another of these strategies, and they're able then to start to implement them and see how that can make a positive effect in their lives. So stopanxietynow.com.
Terrific. Peter, I want to thank you. This has been great. We ran over my normal limit because I didn't want to stop you because I thought the information was fantastic. So I want to thank you. I hope my audience appreciates it. And if they need to get you, they can go to stopanxietynow.com.
It was a pleasure, Howie. Really nice to speak with you today,
too. Speak to you, too. So until next time, this has been Dr. Gurr for The Shrink Is In.
You have been listening to The Shrink Is In, and your host has been Dr. Howard Gurr. If you want to learn more about Dr. Gurr, go to his website at www.drsgurr.com.